It's Sunday night. It's on an April evening, and do not mean it from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York. The John Mack Radio Show is on the air. The producer not bringing up the music. Oh. There we go. There's the end of the count. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 134th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 133 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is JohnMack, so that's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My most recent piece for Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is WestchesterGuardian. It includes the 199th column in the Creative Disruption series. But I hope to read the column, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. You will find the links to all the previous shows and to my online daily free newspaper at my web home. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Next week's guest on April 17th will be Medium blogger Dana George Coleman, and on the following Sunday, April 24th, comedian Chuck Goldstone will join me. The personal note, I broke a foot a week ago and sprained an ankle. The listeners do not want to do that. It's not fun. But it could be worse, much worse. Now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. My guest is author and historian Gail DeMette Buckley. But I've known Gail for over 30 years, since her marriage to my oldest friend, Kevin Buckley. But I've read Gail's three books and have found them to be both the source of information and good reads. I recommend them for all. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here. There.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in Southern California in Hollywood and went to school, public school in Hollywood during World War II. I moved there in 1941. First from Brooklyn, and before that from Pittsburgh, where I was born. Then I went to Brooklyn where my mother was born and grew up in 1940, and then in 1941 I moved to California.
You've written extensively about your lineage back to the Civil War, and we'll get into that. But I'll tell any of the audience that doesn't already know it. Gail is the daughter of the wonderfully gifted entertainer Lena Horne. What was it like growing up with such a famous mother?
Everybody asks that question, and I always give the same answer because I really don't know what to say except that it was fun.
I
enjoyed it.
I remember telling you when I read your first book, The Horns, Ten American Family, that taught me so much about bigotry that I had never seen. I had assumed that when someone like Lena was a great star, that the bigots would crawl back under the rock. But you opened my eyes. I still remember your story of the Los Angeles Girl Scouts than you. Would you tell us that story?
Well, I don't know what that story is. You mean why I wasn't a brownie?
Yeah, you mentioned that Lena brought you to one whatever they call it, a cub meeting.
Oh,
or whatever.
I don't remember that at all. Isn't that funny?
And they suggested that you might be more comfortable at the
some
council.
Some other one. Well, they didn't say it to me, so they said it to my mother, and I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember. But there was, I mean, Hollywood was a very racist place. California, Southern California was a very racist place against Japanese Americans, against Mexican Americans, and against African Americans. My mother had a very privileged life. On the one hand, we lived in Hollywood. We did not live in a ghetto. She was treated royally at MGM, only they cut out her, they cut her scene out of every picture that was ever shot when it was shown in the South. So, and also she never could have a speaking role in a movie. It was all about just singing her song so that it could easily be cut out of the picture when it went South. So it was a modest life of prejudice, not horrendous.
How did you handle that as the young girl? Did you understand it or?
No, I was. I mean, I went there when I was 4 years old, and I certainly didn't understand it until after probably World War II. I understood something about Japanese American, what happened to Japanese Americans, because I remember my mother came home from a singing at a rally for a Japanese American soldier who had his legs, who'd lost his legs in the war, and came home to find that his house had been burned down because there was so much prejudice against Japanese Americans, even though he was an American soldier.
Wow.
I remember her telling me this story, and she said that she had sang America the Beautiful, and he had started crying, and she had started crying. And I didn't really understand it, but I knew it was something important.
Wow.
Because of what she was telling me. So this was probably 1944. How old was I? I was 6 years old.
Do you remember how old you were when you first thought of being a writer?
When I first started being a writer, I was, I was probably 22 or something, working at Life magazine.
Oh, no, I said when you first started being a writer, usually young children have some idea about what they want to do. You mentioned in the introduction of your current book that your mother always wanted you to refer to yourself as American rather than using any racialized identification.
Well, she didn't believe in hyphenated Americanism, like Harry Truman. She believed you were an American, and that was it. Because people used to always say to me, "What are you?" And she would say, when people ask you what you are, just say, "I'm an American."
Yeah. I always felt that way. We'll talk about that later, but I always resented the Irish American or whatever. Tell me about your high school years then.
I went to a Quaker boarding school in Poughkeepsie called Oakwood Friends School, where my favorite teacher was Japanese American, and where the Hiroshima Maidens came to visit because the Quakers were going to see that they had medical treatment. They were young women who'd been terribly burned at Hiroshima and disfigured. And two of my classmates had been in Japanese prison camps in Indonesia.
Wow.
And also one of the people, famous people who went to this school, even though it was a Quaker school, was one of the four chaplains. I don't know if you remember that story from World War II.
The four chaplains.
Yeah, when one of them was an Oakwood graduate.
Yeah, every year there's the remembrance of them at the local American Legion Hall, and my pastors, both from the local Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church, have taken the roles with the rabbi and with another Protestant minister of the four chaplains. And,
well, I'm happy to hear that.
An amazing story for the audience.
Two Protestants, yeah.
Yeah.
Two Protestants, a Jewish and a Catholic.
Yeah. For the audience, there was the ship being sunk, and and when they were abandoning the ship, there weren't enough a life preserver to go around, and these four chaplains gave up their life preservers, and they started praying together as the ship went down, and there's been stories written about them and everything.
They were amazing.
Did you write for your high school paper?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember that we had a paper. I think I wrote for the yearbook, but I don't remember that we had a paper, funnily enough.
And then you went off to Radcliffe.
Then I went to Radcliffe.
What did you major in?
I majored in French.
Okay.
Bizarrely enough, I have no idea why I did that, but I was a great, huge Francophile because I used to go to France every summer almost, and I was a Francophile. And I love French movies, and so I thought, well, I'll major in French. And I actually love 18th century French literature. That was what I concentrated on,
and
Voltaire and all that.
And did you write there at all?
Well, I wrote a thesis on Colette, and I got a magna reading on my thesis, so I only graduated cum laude. I didn't write that much, but I had a very good time.
That's good. And you also worked in JFK's 1958 as Jenna campaign warrior there. What was that like?
I worked in that campaign when he was running for re-election to the Senate. We wanted him to have a huge – he knew he was going to win, but we wanted him to have a huge victory. He'd come to speak at Harvard, and everybody was ready. He had tons of student volunteers. We somehow realized that he was special because he was the only person who was running for office we'd ever heard of who was born in the 20th century. So that's why we were all for him. And I went and worked at his headquarters and stuffed envelopes, mainly. And then later on, when he was actually running for president, I went on it. I was part of the campaign that went on a little plane and went to all the states that he lost in and made a speech with other people.
Terrific. You mentioned that he was the only one born in the 20th century. When Bobby Kennedy was running for the Senate, he spoke in Inwood, and he had gone to Royal Country School, that was the school that my kids went to, and it's very Cliff Boston accent. He said, around the other parts of the state, they don't say they understand my accent, but now that I'm home here, I know that all of you will, you know. And everyone broke up. Yeah. Once again, in the introduction to your current book, you said that you had told JFK that your Harvard graduation, that you planned to go to Paris and never return. And he said he was sure that you would be back. Why did you plan to go not to return? Why was he so sure that you would?
Well, I was graduating. I thought, you know, I was a Francophile. I'd done all this studying about France. And I loved Paris, which I'd only seen in the spring and summer. I'd never spent a winter there. That changed my mind when I spent a winter there. It's always colder indoors than outdoors. And so I just sort of said flippantly, he said, what are you going to do now that you graduate? And I said, I'm going to go to France and never come back. And he'll say, oh, yes, you will. You're an American. So after that winter, I came back, and that's when I went and worked on his campaign for presidency.
What did you do while you were in Paris?
I worked for a magazine called Marie Claire, which actually now publishes in English, but I didn't do any writing. It was just sort of a dopey sort of women's magazine, and I used to sort of arrange cushions, which sounds silly, but really there wasn't that much to do. I didn't get paid. I was an intern.
Oh, okay.
And I lived with a friend from Radcliffe, and we shared an apartment. And it was fun, but then that was when I decided I really didn't like Paris and I missed New York terribly. And I came back home, and that's when I worked for Senator Kennedy.
Then after he was elected, then what did you do after in the U.S.?
Then I went to work for the National Scholarship Service and Fund for Negro Students, which was an agency that helped Negro students find scholarships to college. And I had to go back to school. They sent me to Teachers College to take sociology and social working courses, which I liked very much, except for statistics, because I'm bad at math. And I worked there for a couple of years, and then I went to Life magazine, which was my favorite job ever.
Now, what did you do at Life?
I was started on the clip desk, which is the lowest editorial position where you read all the papers. I was very well informed. You read all the papers, and you clip for the different departments or the different writers or whatever anybody had asked you to or what you thought somebody might be interested in. And you'd guarded the AP and UP wires. And then when the bells rang, you would take the wires up to the editors. That was my job until I got promoted to reporter, which really meant I carried the photographer's stuff. Because it was a photographer's magazine.
Okay. But you wrote the captions and the stories around
right,
the pictures.
Right. I wrote the captions and got everybody's name spelled, tried to get everybody's name spelled right. And carried all the equipment.
Well, the first job that you had is, by and large, replaced by computers now, and the equipment's gotten smaller than smaller, thank God.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen. You know, I haven't. This was early 19. This is 1960, so I haven't really seen anything since then. Because when I in the middle of working at Life magazine, I got married, and my first husband didn't want me to do any work, so I stopped working. And I didn't work again until I was divorced.
That was the old days when things like that happened.
Exactly.
But you did raise two daughters during that period.
Yes.
Until you weren't, and one's been in the movies, and she's written screenplays, and the other's politically active. So you must be proud of them both.
I'm very proud of them both.
Then you're a grandmother.
I'm a grandmother, yes. That's the best.
That's the best. That's probably how Delina felt about them.
Probably. I'm sure it was.
When you went back into the writing market, you appeared in many papers. I read many of your opinion pieces in the New York Daily News. Would you tell us a little about your writing?
Well, I wrote for the Daily News. I wrote for Vogue. I wrote for America Magazine, the Jesuit magazine. I had a column there. I had a column, an occasional column in the Daily News under the editor then, Ed Kosner. And I wrote, I did a couple of things for the New York Times. So I was free, and I worked for People magazine in the very beginning because I had been a Life alumni. So I thought, that was when I first divorced. I did a couple of articles in People.
I had a
very new.
An ex-columnist on from the Daily News who might have crossed with you, Dennis Hamill, I had on last week.
Yeah, I didn't know him, but I knew who he was for sure.
And you probably knew his brother Pete also.
Sure, I knew Pete. I knew Pete Hamill. I knew him.
Yeah, what did you concentrate in normally in your columns, whether in America or in the Daily News?
In America, I talked about religion. In the Daily News, I sort of talked about religion and politics. In Vogue, I did some book reviews. The Times articles that I was asked to do, one about movies, I can't remember, movies, that sort of thing.
I mentioned your first book earlier, of the Horns, the American Family. What prompted the book with the focus on the immediate family history?
Well, I was looking for a job, and I got a job, and it was so terrible. I was the oldest person in the office. I was out of my home all the time, and I couldn't stand it being away from my children. So I decided I needed to do something that I could do at home. And I had my grandfather's trunk, which I'd never gone through, but it would sort of come to me. I opened the trunk, and there was this whole history. He came from a generation that never threw anything away. So I found all these photographs and letters, and just it was like a whole story, and that was the Horns.
I had a photographer on about maybe 6 months ago, and she said the one thing that the new digital revolution has to change that she's not happy with is that we don't have these troves of photographs. She said she first got interested in photography, just as you mentioned, with the grandfather's trunk, and then now everything is on a hard disk, or it's up in the cloud, or it's on the USB drive, or it's on your cell phone, and you don't know where the pictures are after a while. And there isn't this collection of history in photographs the way they used to be.
No, and there are no letters because everybody sends emails.
Right.
And I have letters from the 19th century. So it's sad for future historians.
Right. As I stated earlier, it's a remarkable book, and I recommend it to everyone.
Are you talking about Black Calhouns?
I didn't get up there yet. I'm talking about the the Horns, the American Family.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope you'll talk about my new book.
I certainly will. We will get there. 5 years after your book, Kevin's Panama, the whole story came out to a wonderful review in the New York Times. What was it like having? That must have been satisfying having having two published books in the family.
It was great. We had separate offices, so it was perfect.
And you just got into computers, as I remember. I note there's been the space of 15 years between your next two books. I imagine that much of the two times must have been spent in research because of the tremendous amount of detail in each. The first of the two.
Research. And I was also writing. Yeah, I guess I'm always a long time between books. I'm a very slow writer, and I research. That's almost my favorite thing. And then I'm also living my life, you know, so I wasn't a disciplined writer for a long time.
The first of the two books, which story for the American Patriots, the story of blacks in the military from the revolution, to assume, came out in 2001 with high praise from such as General Colin Powell. Tell us about how you decided to attempt such a massive undertaking and how you gather all your material.
Well, it was something that I'd left out of the Horns. I'd been especially interested in one of my great uncles who had died in the First World War. And he had grown up in Brooklyn, like everybody in my mother's family. And around 1912, he joined the Army, and he was sent to Texas or New Mexico or something like that. And he instantly became a sergeant, because that was the highest rank you could go at that time if you were black. And then he was in the 24th Infantry, I guess, and they were part of the unit that went to chase Pancho Villa in 1917, and that was a very big campaign, the Mexican campaign. John J. Pershing was the commander in charge of chasing Pancho Villa, who they never found, of course. But he had invaded a city in either Texas or New Mexico, I can't remember which, and killed some American soldiers. And so the Americans were after him. And it was a lost cause. They couldn't find him. But the black military became great heroes in that war because they rescued a white cavalry unit, Custer's old unit, and it was a great thing. And so my great uncle was promoted to second lieutenant in time for the First World War, and he became a second lieutenant. But then he died in the influenza pandemic right after that, so he didn't really see much action. I was interested in the story of blacks in the military because of him. So I decided to study.
How did you get the information both on him, or was that family history, which isn't always the most accurate, and how did you get all the
learned? Right, and also it was very difficult to get any information about him because there had been a huge fire in the military records place in Pennsylvania, and he was part of his records had gone. But he was my takeoff point in the sense of my being interested. And then I just went and studied blacks in the military from source material and discovered that one out of every five soldiers in Washington's army by the end of the Revolutionary War was black.
I didn't know that.
That was a surprise. Oh, yeah. Mostly from New England.
I did know that from reading the book, but I had lost it completely. So even at that time during the British occupation, there were free blacks in the North End, I guess then.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And they went to war, and sometimes they fought with the British, but mostly they fought in Washington's army.
Okay.
In the Revolutionary Army.
Chris
Bizadix, you've heard of him, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay. So he was black.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, he was, that was obviously before the revolution. Even.
Yeah, just before Bunker Hill and all that.
Yeah. And what about 1812?
1812, there were a lot of black soldiers in 1812. They fought with Andrew Jackson. They were mostly, a lot of them were new, were Louisiana pirates, which are on our feet. And they formed the big defense of New Orleans under Andrew Jackson. They were in the front lines.
Now,
and there were also a group of free blacks from New Orleans who fought. They were famous French-speaking people.
Now, because of Jackson's treatment of the Indians, he was always considered a racist. Was he a racist toward his black soldiers?
Well, he wasn't a racist. He didn't treat his soldiers badly, but he probably was a racist.
Okay.
I mean, Pershing was a racist who was good to some of his soldiers some of the time. He was bad to them in the First World War. In the Mexican campaign, he said, I could take these, and in the Spanish-American War, he said, we white officers could have kissed our black heroes. But in the First World War, he wrote a directive to the French not to praise black officers, not to praise black troops, not to make friends with them outside of the line of duty, blah, blah, blah. The French burned the directive. So, you know, you are not a racist, particularly if you need the manpower.
I remember that one of the speakers at your mother's funeral in 2010 was one of the Tuskegee Airmen. Did he know Lena before, or was his presence a result of your interview for the book?
No, no. She was called the sweetheart of the Tuskegee Airmen. She was the queen of the 99th Pursuit Squadron. She went to every black basic training camp in America and sang. She did that during the war. She was a great war figure to the blacks. She was their only pinup that they were allowed.
I know it's difficult to encapsulate such a fact-filled book in a few sentences. You obviously had much to learn from your research. Was there any one thing or a few things that you learned that had changed your understanding or beliefs about the subject?
Well, I must say I was not prepared to find out how racist the American government had been during World War II. I knew how bad it was during World War II. I discovered what a racist Woodrow Wilson was, who resegregated Washington, D.C., which had been desegregated in the Civil War. And he was an absolute horror. I mean, there were black troops in some troop ships who were not given life-saving equipment. They were expected to use floating debris. He did not want blacks to bear arms for America. Therefore, he gave black National Guard troops to the French. The two units, black American units that fought in World War I, actually in combat, fought with the French army in French uniforms. And then in World War II, I mean, my mother refused to sing at a camp in Arkansas because they put the German prisoners of war in front of the black GIs for her show.
Wow.
It was horrible. So that was going, and that surprised me.
Before we leave the book, could you spend some time discussing Harry Truman's decision to desegregate the armed forces? What led up to that? What opposition did he face? What was the immediate impact?
I have to rack my brain for this one. The worst thing to ask a writer is what she wrote about a long time ago. Harry Truman in 1948 was facing the Progressive Party on the left and the Dixiecrats on the right. And the Dixiecrats had been formed because he desegregated the military. And he desegregated the military for the same reason that he recognized Israel, the State of Israel. He needed the votes. He was really in trouble. And he was also basically a good guy in the sense that when he inherited his ward in Kansas City, he had a lot of blacks in the ward. So he knew black people. And what happened was, because he desegregated the military, my mother had been for Henry Wallace, the progressive candidate. And she'd been, because of her friend Paul Robeson, who was really her grandmother's friend, her grandparents' friend. And the minute that Truman desegregated the military, she then campaigned for Truman. And she sang at his inaugural. But that was a very, very, very big thing for black Americans because they had fought in every war since the Revolution and been essentially dissed in every war. And, they didn't like Eisenhower, for example, because he testified against desegregating the military when it was when it came up. And funnily enough, some of the most people who were thought of as two of the most people generals who were thought of as racist turned out to be the ones who said we'll take black soldiers and we'll use them well were Patton and MacArthur. So it was a, and Eisenhower was not a good guy, and Mark Clark was the worst. So it was Marshall was good. So you had this sort of, you didn't know what you were going to get. It just depended on the general.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing that if you go through history, so many contributions have been made by blacks in the military, and it took to 1948. It's just like about the same time, probably 1951, there was the big deal that the Archbishop of New Orleans was integrating the churches, and there was a staunch racist, the Leandro Perez, who had been the public official, who was excommunicated and all this. Everyone was so praising of the Archbishop. And my immediate reaction is, where have they been since the time of Jesus Christ? You know, why is it a big deal now? Why didn't it happen, you know?
No white church. But I mean, the Catholics were better than any other religion because they sent priests to minister to Catholic, to black people, and nuns
right.
ministered to black people. And this bishop quite rightly excommunicated the racists in New Orleans.
Right.
Who didn't want to integrate the schools. But there had been a black president of Georgetown.
Yes.
One of the Healy brothers. And a black bishop in Maine. So, the Catholic Church was actually better in some ways. And they certainly, in slavery, I mean, certainly they profited from slavery, but any areas that were Catholic treated the slaves better. They did not. They would never sell away children from their parents, for example. They legalized marriage or sanctified marriages so they wouldn't break up families. So there was, certain Christian values did apply.
The year after your book was published, an adaptation for young readers was published. What prompted the adaptation? Did you do it? And if so, what was
the
process?
No, I didn't do it. Somebody else did it. I just took the money.
And why was it considered necessary? Why was it adapted? Just to make it shorter?
Because they thought it was a story that young people would like or be interested in.
Okay.
Which it was. I mean, young people, it's something that young people should know about. And I think they rewrote it. Shortened it and rewrote it to be accessible to young people.
Did you have any editorial oversight or any editorial?
No,
input?
No. I trusted them completely. Whatever they wanted to do.
Okay. And that brings us to your current book, the Black Calhoun from Civil War to Civil Rights with one African American family. The book to trace your family history from slavery to you and your daughters. What was the impetus for this work?
Well, I had all this material that I found after my mother died from the southern side of the family, which I knew nothing about. The side of the family when my great-great-grandfather had a sister, and his sister's family stayed in Atlanta when his daughters moved north, his daughters being my great-grandmother and her sister. So I was fascinated by this family who stayed in Atlanta and had a very good life, very successful life, because I thought that if you lived in the South, if you stayed in the South and didn't go north in the 1880s when my great-grandmother went north, that you had a miserable, oppressive life. Well, they were oppressed politically, but they were very successful otherwise and had happy lives, happier in a way than a lot of the northern part of the family did. There was no divorce, no adultery, none of that going on in the South. They were great churchgoers, and they were doctors, and they were businessmen. They were people who didn't really need white support. So and they turned inward. And it was all about family and friends and clubs and church. And they obviously, it was easier in the North to bring up your children when you didn't have white-only signs on museums and parks and theaters. but that didn't but it didn't stop them from having really good lives, and that's what interested me.
Do you think that was because they were in an urban area? I mean, you also read about during the same time.
Yeah, Atlanta was a very good town to be black in, to be black middle class in, because Atlanta was a business place, not a planter town. And it was and they had one eye on the North all the time because they wanted Northern investment. So you could be a black Republican, you could own your own home, you could buy property, you could be successful in Atlanta, which you could not if you lived in a rural district. But the rest of Georgia was a nightmare.
I would think that the research for this book might have been even more difficult than the preceding one, was it?
No, because I had the family had given me all this material, and I'd learned so much from my other books. So I sort of put it all together.
I know that your work on this book has been greatly impacted by the major strokes suffered by your husband, my friend Kevin. I've been so impressed by the calmness and positive attitude that you've shown through this crisis. How were you able to keep working and to get the book out the door with the turmoil caused by Kevin's
death? Actually, I used to work I get up at 5 every morning and work before he got up, and then my rest of my day could be devoted to Kevin. And we both fall asleep at 6:30. This is late for me, John. Way past my bedtime.
Okay. To take you back to the introduction of the book, you mentioned that you now identify yourself as an African-American to let others know that you are one of America's historical stepchildren. That's both a very strong and poignant statement. I rejected Irish American years ago for myself because I thought that the carrot of divided loyalty was the term that separated me from Italian Americans and Jewish Americans. I've thought about that more recently, by the way, though. Do you think there will be the time that you or your descendants will be comfortable reverting to your mother's just plain American?
Well, I personally have reverted to that. This is only sort of officially that I say I call myself. I mean, if someone asks me what I am, I say African American. But I don't believe in hyphenated. Also, I have no loyalty to Africa. My ancestors in Africa came from Senegal. I don't know what's going on in Senegal. I don't really care. I mean, I should care, I suppose. But it's not where I live. It's not where what I'm concerned with. It's not where I vote. So I don't have divided loyalties. Any way, shape, or form. I mean, my ancestors came over before the revolution. So, I have no ties to Africa.
A few months ago, I had Lucian Truscott the IV on the radio show. He's a third generation graduate of West Point and direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson. For well over 15 years, he's been trying to get the Monticello Association, the official organization of Jefferson descendants, of which he's a member, to accept the descendants of the Hemings line into the organization. And when the vote is taken, and his immediate family are the only proponents of admission. Are you familiar with the Hemings line? Have you done any?
Well, I know the story from... I actually met Lucian Truscott a few years ago, but I know the story from Annette Gordon Reed's book and her studies.
And why do you think? I mean, he said he was very open. He said they say, well, it's not properly documented. They need documentation. He said no one asked me if I was I showed up and I said I'm a direct descendant, and they said fine. But they're keeping all these people out. Do you understand that? I guess that's the question.
Well, it's pretty clear. Wouldn't you say it was pretty clear?
Yes, and
it's prejudice. That's what it is.
But I mean, understand it is here we are in the 21st century, and you mentioned that the book comes up to the Civil Rights Act and everything. Do you understand how the people that can still carry these prejudices after all this time?
Well, yes, because it's human nature. Everybody's always got to have somebody to look down on. This has been ingrained in these people forever. I'm always surprised, in fact, when I meet a good Southerner, quote unquote, especially of a certain age. I'm not surprised.
Well, but you mentioned Atlanta. You had the great Southerner there, then Ralph McGill, the editor of the Atlanta Constitution.
Yeah, and they had a couple of very good mayors, too, Hartsfield and I can't remember who the other one was. They had a couple of very good people. Atlanta was always kind of good. And when I was in Atlanta, I met both black Calhouns and white Calhouns, and we all chatted and had a lovely time. So it just depends. And I think the Jefferson situation there, you know, I'm sure there's a little bit of snobism in that, besides everything else.
Was the chapter on the post-boy years with the tax and Lena for her left-wing politics, the racial slights against her, and her relationship with her second husband being a crime in many states, difficult for you to write with that pain so close to home?
No, it wasn't difficult. It was just the facts. No. Never brought up to think it was difficult, you know, so I didn't have it difficult. I didn't feel difficult about it. I adored my stepfather. He was wonderful.
It's hard to understand that California, that we now consider generally the left-wing state like New York, had an anti...
California was a very racist state. But in 1947 or 1950, one or the other, I forget which, they threw away that law. The anti-miscegenation law was declared unconstitutional by the state. But they had always it was mainly anti-Mexican and anti-Asian. And it was anti-black, too. It was anti-people of color. They were very prejudiced because a lot of people who settled in California came from the South. They had a famously bad police. I mean, Southern California was famously bad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Police.
In Los Angeles, particularly.
But there was a very good governor, Earl Warren, and Upton Sinclair came from California. So there were a lot of, you know, there were some progressives, many progressives. Who was that great guy? The National the Maritime in San Francisco.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Boy.
I can't remember his name.
He was called a communist.
Yeah, they called him a communist. Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, They threw his local out of the AFL-CIO. His name is...
There was always a sort of conflict between the left and the right in California. And the movie people were very conservative. I mean, the big bosses were very conservative.
Yeah. I seem to remember that they felt that one of the most oppressed people that ruined her life was Dorothy Dandridge. I remember that.
Well, I don't know if that was racism that ruined her life. I mean, everybody suffered racism, everybody black. I think she had unfortunate personal life.
Yeah. Speaking of that, and just you write beautifully about your mother, would you like to take a few minutes to describe it to the audience that might only know of the great Lena Horne?
How do you mean?
Well, people have this persona of her, her skill, her style, her stage warmth, the class that she exhibited, but they don't have, I'm sure, a good personal understanding of her. And I was hoping that you could expand.
Gee, that's hard. That's very hard. They should read the book. I don't even know where to begin to say my personal understanding. I mean, this is someone I knew for, you know, till she was 92, and I was in my 70s, and we had a very normal life of mother-daughter. I mean, it was abnormal, but it was also normal. It was abnormal because she was a working mother in a very glamorous life, but it was normal. Our interaction was very normal. There was no sort of Joan Crawford business going on. She was very, very, very strict about education because that was the way she'd been brought up. And she always felt that she hadn't had a good education because her mother had taken her out of girls' high school in Brooklyn to put her in the Cotton Club when she was 16. So she had to be self-educated. And she always was reading. She was a huge reader. And she really was a self-educated person.
Well, and reading the book, she obviously educated herself politically because she had both strong feelings but an understanding of the issues.
She was educated, yeah, she was educated by the people she met along the way, especially the people she met at Cafe Society, because that was basically a fundraiser for the American Communist Party. And when she first went there to audition, she sang Sleepy Time Down South and Down Argentina Way. And this wonderful man called Barney Josephson, who ran the place, said, "Do you know what you're singing? You can't sing these songs." She said, "Yeah, I know what I'm singing. These are popular songs." So he educated her on why she shouldn't sing a song about the South and why she shouldn't sing about Down Argentina Way, because people would think she was trying to pass. And then Paul Robeson, who was her grandmother's mentee, educated her and said, you are not yet, you don't know who you are yet. You have to become Lena Horne Negro." And she thought, "Oh my God, what does that mean?" And he meant that she said, "You must not forget the people down the line. You must not forget the Pullman porters. You have to uplift like your grandmother did." So all of these people educated her, and Walter White was on her case. So she really got an education in what it meant to be black in America, which she hadn't ever thought about.
Robeson also told him not to join the Communist Party.
He did indeed. She was invited to join the Communist. She was wooed by the Communists in Hollywood. And she said to Paul, "Should I join the party?" He said, "Absolutely not." Nobody ever knows whether he was a party member. He was certainly a fellow traveler, but nobody knows if he was a party member. Many people think he wasn't. But he couldn't say anything because he had many friends in Russia.
It certainly ruined his professional career, though. So,
well, the blacklists, the red baiters, right, ruined his career.
Right.
They destroyed him. They meant to. Because he was beloved.
I read a wonderful biography of him that must be 20 years ago, and I can't think of who wrote it or the...
What was his name? I know what you... It was a great, great, great thick tome, and it was wonderful.
Yes, yes.
I can't remember his name, but it was beautiful. He was a beautiful man in every way.
Did you know him personally?
Well, I sat in his lap as a child. Wow. He sang Russian lullabies. That's about as far as I knew him. I took my daughter to his funeral.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where was his funeral?
At the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem.
Okay.
And I must say the police were so nice, because there were all these little old ladies, because his brother had been pastor of that church for a million years. And so they were all there. And then you had these sort of young socialists. It was a very, very, very moving experience. And Paul singing in the background.
Was that before Adam Clayton Powell was the pastor there?
I don't think it was the same church.
Oh, okay.
Mother Zion. It was Mother Zion, not the Abyssinian Baptist. Mother Zion Church.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about Dr. Homer Dean Nash, the subject of the last chapter in your book.
Oh, he was, as far as I know, only what I know, what you see in the book. He was a young doctor. He'd become a doctor. In 1910, he got his medical license in Atlanta. He opened his practice, and he fell in love with my, with my great-grandfather's, great-great-grandfather's granddaughter, or great-granddaughter. He was part of the Atlanta family. And her father didn't want her to marry him because he wasn't successful yet. But they prevailed, and they had this wonderful long marriage. And he became not only the longest practicing black doctor in Georgia, but the longest practicing doctor of any race in Atlanta. And he was a beloved figure. And when he died, it was a big deal in the white papers as well as the black papers. And he had been a doctor in World War I.
So why did you choose him to finish up the book?
Well, because he was a great family member who had all his honors. He died in the same month that my mother had her Broadway show opened, her last Broadway show opened. And I figured it was a sort of tribute to honors in the North for my mother and honors in the South for this other, for this cousin. And that was why I finished with him.
Have you met his descendants?
Oh, yeah. They're the Black Calhouns of Atlanta, still.
Now, you mentioned that you've been with both the Black Calhouns and the White Calhouns together down south. Is there an organization similar to
No. Not at this point.
Black
Calhouns had a family reunion in the 80s, I guess. And the White Calhouns and the Black Calhouns both came to my reading. So that was how I got to know the White Calhouns. One of them had written me before. They're very nice people, and they are not at all like the Jeffersons.
And
they were happy
you,
to be related.
Would you consider trying to put an organization together, since you know all these people?
I wouldn't consider it, but I'd be delighted to be a part of anybody who did consider it. I don't have the time for that. You realize you'd have to track down everybody, and no, I wouldn't do it. But if anybody wanted to do it, I'd certainly support them.
Is there anything in particular that you like to add about the present book?
Well, I think it's a wonderful read. It's gotten wonderful reviews. I got a very good review in the New York Times, a rave review in the Boston Globe. It's going to be a miniseries. It was sold to ABC. So I think I just hope people will buy it, because it's not.
Yeah.
It's a very good read.
Would you be involved with the screenplay or anything?
No.
No? Okay.
I will consult, but I will not write it.
Okay. But will you have any editorial say?
Well, I'll consult. You know, they're going to whatever consulting means.
Okay. I'll add for the audience, buy the book, either in hardcover or on Kindle or Nook. What's next for you?
Cleaning my room. Cleaning my office.
Don't do
cleaning
projects.
My apartment.
Don't do projects in line?
Not at the moment. I just need a rest.
Okay. We've touched a lot of the basis tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about Gail and Matt Buckley?
Well, John, I've been delighted to be on your show. I really can't think of anything.
Okay.
You must have another question or two.
No, I think to have touched many of the bases, other than House Kevin.
Kevin is doing really well. Thank you very much for asking. And he sends you his very best. And we send Barbara our very best.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Gail. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for asking me, John. And what are you doing next? I know are you thinking of writing any more, like something longer?
Oh, well, I'm about to do my 200th column in my Crib Disruption series for a Westchester paper. And there's been talk of putting them together in a book. This, I mentioned, is the 134th show in this series. And I did cut some CDs with all of the interviews on it that I might do something with. And
great.
I do have another novel in the back of my head. And I do some short stories out. But between teaching 2 days a week and the preparation and the weekly column and the radio show and the daily newspaper.
You don't have time.
It keeps me busy, yeah.
Yeah, it's tough.
But
you've got that. See, I was lucky to have those morning hours, because otherwise I could never have written it.
Yeah, well, it's amazing, though. You've done a terrific job, and I certainly hope the big success. You deserve it.
Thank you, John. Thank you so very much, and thanks for having me on your show. And I'm sorry I didn't hear Count Basie going into April in Paris. That's what it was, right?
That was it, and we'll go off with him in a moment after I tell people that a bit of commercial information. My column now appears bi-weekly in Westchester Guardian. It's available both in print format and on the web, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. my books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. That's J-O-H-N-M-A-C-R-A-N-T-S. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Join me next week, the Medium blogger Dana Georgia Coleman. And as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. So go on with the count, too. Did your mother ever sing with him?
What? No. But she loved him.
Did your mother ever sing
him.
With him?
He was a lovable man. Everybody loved him.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night, John.